Reading with your kids.
Hola, ni hao, konnichiwa, assalamu alaikum, shalom, mahaba, bonjour, ciao, namaste, jumbo. Bienvenidos. Hey, my name is Jed Lee, and this is Reading with Your Kids, coming to you with love from the historic neighborhood of Reedville, tucked into the southwest corner of beautiful Boston, Massachusetts. Our mission here is all about connection, connecting kids with books, families with each other, and communities through the power of story. Every week, we're joined by incredible authors and creators whose work lights up kids' lives. You can support this mission by spreading the word, share the show with your friends, give us a shout-out at school, and let everyone know that they can hear us on the WREB AM-FM 24-7 radio network, and they can find us on the iHeartRadio app, on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, YouTube, GoodPods, CastBox, Audible, Player FM, wherever you find your favorite shows, you can find Reading with Your Kids. Two wonderful guests for you today. First up, Susie Spickle will be here to celebrate the Book of Fairies. And later in the show, former reality TV producer Rusty Austin is here to celebrate his new picture book. It's called An Awesome Bird, The Pelican. We also get Rusty to spill a little reality TV dirt.
Hi, I'm Ashley, a first-time author who loves turning real animals into big adventures for our littles.
And I'm Michael, a scientist, international educator, and textbook author. Ashley and I have teamed up to bring the Wildlife Belize right into your hands.
Kids will meet real animals like jaguars and tapirs and learn about the struggles they face in the wild. With artwork by local student illustrators, these animals truly come to life for your kids.
And for teachers, we built K-5 toolkits to make it easy to integrate these books into the classroom, all with age-appropriate activities that connect literacy, science, and wildlife conservation.
You can learn more at ashleymosley.com or inspiredventures.com. Let's keep the adventure going.
Hey families, would you like to share a miracle with your kids? At the Wolf Conservation Center, hope was fading. The endangered Mexican wolves dreamed of a pup, but none had come. Until one tiny miracle changed everything. Meet Trumpet, a real-life wolf pup whose incredible birth brought joy, hope, and a lesson in conservation. Trumpet the Miracle Wolf, written by Leocadia George, is a heartwarming true story that will inspire your whole family. Teach your kids the power of hope, love, and protecting endangered species. Get your copy today and join the wild adventure. We are in for a treat. Our guest is returning to Reading with Your Kids, coming to us from the great state of New Hampshire. She's celebrating the Book of Fairies. Please welcome back to the show, Susie Spickle. Susie, how are you?
I'm great, Jed. How about you?
I'm fantastic. Susie and I were just catching up, talking about pickles and cousins and all sorts of great things. And I can't wait to start talking about the Book of Fairies.
Me either.
So tell us about this book.
Oh, this book is really close to my heart. I actually started it when I was about 8. So in the Book of Fairies, there are fairies from traditional Eastern and Western European mythology, like brownies or dryads and things like that, she-fae, kind of fairies you find in your typical fairy book, but mixed in are fairies that I invented when I was a kid to explain kind of natural phenomena, like the bubblinis, which are little fairies that live inside bubbles. And when I was a kid, I blew a lot of bubbles on my stoop, and I noticed that there were rainbows inside the bubble, and I didn't understand why, so I made up a story, and the story was that there was a fairy family that lived inside the bubble that gave it the rainbow. And so those stories sort of stuck with me all the way through now, and I'm so excited to share kind of my imagination of fairies and the deep, rich folklore of fairies from Eastern and Western Europe.
Yeah, you know, my beautiful wife and I had a trip to Scotland and Ireland, and as we were going around, especially there was this one. We were in Ireland, and we got up early one morning. We had a ride on a horse-drawn carriage through like this wood. I think they call it a garden, but it was a lot of woods, and there were a lot of ABCs. That's another bloody castle. But they were always talking about the fairies that were hiding out in the woods, and they weren't always nice. They were kind of mischievous, I think.
Yes, yeah. There's a deep fairy culture and fairy mythology goes way back, and it's cross-cultural. It's across many different cultures that the wee folk appear, and they can be very sweet and grant wishes. Think of like something like a fairy godmother, and in my book I call them the Mumskies and Grumskies. They might grant you a wish, but there are fairies that are notoriously mischievous, such as the Knockers, which are lived in mines and would play trick on the miners. And that's just an example of one of the fairies that was mischievous. In my book, I make them, they are the originators of the knock-knock joke. So I had a lot of fun researching fairies. I've always loved fairy mythology. I was one of those kids that was deep into it and continued throughout my life. If you could see the bookshelves behind me, you would see that they're loaded with a lot of fairy tale books. Mm-hmm. And it was such a pleasure for me to write a book that really celebrated fairies and introduced some new fairies and kind of reminded us all of some of the older fairies in the canon of fairies.
Yeah. You know, I'm fascinated. One of the things that I used to and often do times talk about in my educational magic shows is the fact that the golden rule that we call the, you know, treat others the way you would want people to treat you. There are so many different versions of that in cultures all over the world that existed before we were communicating with each other, before we knew that the earth was round and that there were people on the other side of this big thing of water. We had different versions of that rule. And the same thing with fairies. It's like, yeah, these people have no way to communicate with each other and tell these stories, yet fairies pop up in all these disparate English is escaping me right now. Must be a fairy. The Knockers are knocking me sense out of me. These stories exist. So I'm like, how do they happen with these people who have no way of communicating with each other?
Well, I mean, I'm a believer in that there's a truth in every story, in every mythology, in every folktale. And it is possible that, you know, if we open our mind up to other ways of being and the more than human world, there might be things afoot that we can't really explain. And so perhaps there are really wee folk. And as we get older and further away from kind of being open to that kind of thinking, the more we discount it. But maybe we shouldn't be so fast to discount it. I especially love that fairies are often protectors of the natural world, which as a naturalist, which is my profession, I teach people about nature. It's not a surprise to me that I would be drawn to who the fairies are, because they really are about that deep connection to nature. And in a lot of stories, if you mistreat nature and the fairies catch you, you are in trouble. And that is across the world. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of a reminder of how to be in balance with the natural world in many ways.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned that you're a naturalist. Where did your love for nature and the earth come from?
Well, it really started with story. I loved stories. My mother was a wonderful storyteller. And I think that was my first idea that really magical things can happen outside. And I might have spent my time outside looking for fairies and gnomes and pixies and things like that, which I did and still do. Unicorns. I was a big unicorn searcher. But in that process of looking for those things, I spent a lot of time outside and discovered that the science, the things that we can actually see in nature, like a butterfly, a caterpillar transforming into a butterfly, or watching a chipmunk put acorns in its mouth, those are pretty magical experiences when you're a child. And that's kind of what went into my heart. and became something that I pursued as a profession. And I really love where story and nature kind of come to the crossroads together.
Yeah. I have to tell you, Susie, this morning I was taking a hike. Our studios here in Reedville are just a mile or so away from the Blue Hills Reservation here in greater Boston. And I was hiking the trails around Houghton's Pond. And I looked up. I had my headphones on. I was listening to a book. And I saw this flash in front of me go into the woods. And I'm like, that's either a person hunched over and running in the woods in a very weird way, or a creature that I really don't want to encounter right now.
So, yeah, I think sometimes that door is open for us, maybe when we're kind of in that liminal space, that in-between space. Like you might have been listening to this book and you were walking and the natural world is all around you and your senses are firing and you're kind of like in this, you're neither here nor there. And that's kind of what the fairy land is. It's the in-between space. And maybe you had a little gift of something like that. I always look for those opportunities. I don't always find them. I mean, I have been doing a lot of talk about my fairy book in different places. And it's really interesting how many adults will share that they have had experiences with fairies and seen them and felt their presence. And I just love that because I think it's really hopeful that there's more to the world than we can really see. And we believe in a lot of things about our world that we can't really see or touch. We have a lot of faith in those things. So why not have that about fairies as well?
You know what's really kind of sending shivers up and down my spine, Susie, is the book that I was listening to was kind of about being in that those in-between spaces in consciousness and what it is. And, I'm glad I didn't encounter that creature close enough. It was down the
well, whatever you do, according to all of my reading and research, there's a couple of rules in fairy world. Number one, don't ever accept any food or drink from a fairy because then you just won't ever come back to this world unless you want to. And then the other thing is this, you'll notice in many, many stories, there's like the rule of three where you get kind of like three times or three chances. And it might be that, you know, there's three sisters and the first two sisters don't treat somebody well and they don't get the reward at the end. But the last sister, the youngest, the littlest, the least, one that anybody paid attention to learns and she does treat, you know, this, let's say, fairy well, and then she's rewarded in the end. So you get three chances, but try to be nice on the first chance. That's a good advice.
I do that, and right now I'm very nice to AI in case that's a fairy that takes over the world. I wanted to remember that I was one of the nice guys.
Hysterical.
One of the things that I love, and I think I shared this with my kids who were growing up, but definitely if I was a parent of a young one now, I would definitely be, sharing with them that, you know, there's a lot about the world that we know. There's a lot about the world that we think we know. But there's a whole lot more of the world that we have, like, no idea over. And we should really, when we're listening to the so-called experts, like, okay, but leave that door open for further exploration.
Yes, I think that's such great advice, Jed. And I feel like that as a naturalist, as somebody who deals in the world of science, I often feel like my job as a naturalist is sort of like a communicator between what the scientists are finding out about a specific animal to the general public. I'm sort of like the translator. And one thing that I know over the course of my 30 years of being a naturalist is that information changes based on new data and new techniques into knowing things. And science is really an evolving concept. And to think that everything is fixed and known is really short-sighted. It stops us from being curious. I think curiosity is the best kind of tool to growing and learning and expanding our thoughts on things. Yeah. So yeah, whether that's through science, you know, you're looking at science or even the idea of, you know, could there be things that we can't quite perceive that are in this world, like fairies or, you know, hobgoblins or ghosts or whatever.
I think that's so important. And it really, I kind of get really disappointed and I feel sad for folks who are, who started their life really curious and got into sciences or archaeology or, you know, naturalists. And they were very curious at the beginning of their career, but they've come to the point where it's like, well, I'm an expert now and I know this. And when something comes in and there's a kind of a monkey wrench thrown in there and there's new information, a lot of times those people are the last ones to catch on and open up and say, okay, the world's not the way I thought it was.
Yeah, I know. There's a lot of investment in science. You know, you got to come out and you come out with your theory and you've got your data and your hypothesis and all this information. And then when somebody else kind of looks at it a different way, you might have to kind of re-examine your original study. And that can be really hard because you've had all this investment in it. And, you know, maybe there's a different way of thinking about how we teach science and how we kind of open the door to that science as an evolving study where things change based on new information. And especially as we are developing a lot of new technology, you know, there's so many things that we're learning from the idea of, like, I'll just share an example of something like cats, wild cats, like mountain lions or bobcats. You know, the original thinking, if you look at a lot of field guides, is that they're very solitary animals, that they don't intermix, that they're the lone cat, you know, and you can kind of think about that, the story of the cat who walks alone. They're different than wolves because wolves and wild canines have more of a social relationship. But there's a lot of camera trapping going on using remote cameras, and they're finding out that that these cats are not necessarily as solo, alone, as we originally thought, that there's a lot more interaction that goes on than we ever knew about or thought we knew about. So that's just a really small example. And what does that mean about cats? I don't know, but it's different than what I had originally read in my field guides. Yeah. So they've got to rewrite the field guides.
Wow. Wow. You know, I thought I saw a black bobcat in my neighbor's backyard. I know it's very rare, but I did look it up and it said, yeah, they're here. They're blacks, not so much, but they could be. So I don't know. I like to think that I saw it.
I like that too. I mean, there's such variation in the natural world. And again, it's good to just be open to what you think you see and hopefully get an opportunity to see it again or get a trail camera out and see if you can capture it, because that's all such great information. And I mean, this is far afield from the topic of fairies, but one thing that I really love about the type of science that I do at my work is a lot of it is citizen science, or I like to call it community science. So it's more inclusive. Mm-hmm. And this idea that we just as regular folk can actually contribute to scientific data by recording what we see, by sharing what we are photographing. And there's so many platforms to do that through, whether it's iNaturalist or eBird or Seek or you know, different types of platforms that you can share what you're noticing, or different projects that you can be involved in your community. And all of that is helping us get a better idea of the world that we're living in.
Yeah. You know, as we're chatting, I'm thinking back and imagining my daughter was still small enough to sit on my lap. And she's small enough to sit in my lap, but she's a woman now. So, but I'm thinking this, but the Book of Fairies would be a great, she would have loved reading about the different fairies and then insisted on going on a hike through the woods and just to see what we might be able to see.
Yeah, I that's actually why I wrote the book. It's a companion book to my book that came out in April, Forest Magic for Kids, which was all about the imaginative space that nature gives children. So the Book of Fairies is filled with over 30 different fairies. They're divided into earth, air, fire, and water fairies. And there's like 8 in each group. And there's kind of, I set it up like a field guide. So similar for what a naturalist would like to do and how I might look at the world. So there's sort of a description. And then there's a section of their friends, or you can think of it as animal allies, like who are you going to find with them? And then my favorite section is how to find them. So where would you go to look for them? And the whole idea of the Book of Fairies is not just to celebrate story and imagination, but to encourage families to take the book outside with them and see if they can find those things, or maybe make up their own fairies, maybe make up their own things that they're finding, give them their own names. So it's really an invitation for children and families to head outside and be curious.
You know, I'm thinking that the Book of Fairies is one of those books that it's a beautiful book and you want to take care of, but I think that you'd be, if you walked into somebody's home and you found their version of or their copy of the Book of Fairies and it was all dirty and bent up and marked on and notes in and maybe a leaf or two in between pages, that would make you really happy.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I would be so excited, because then I would know that the book was also being used and not only read, but used as a tool for imagination and for, you know, we go outside and we see the world, and when we're grown-ups, like, we're into this naming thing. Oh, that's a maple tree, and there's an acorn, and this is a chipmunk, and this is a Phoebe bird. You know, we're all about, like, naming things. But the Book of Fairies is really like an invitation to let it all go and let your mind go wild and find some new things to make up, some new things to discover. So, yes, I would be excited if the Book of Fairies spent a lot of time outside in the hands of families.
You know, I had an experience last year. My car needed brakes, emergency. I didn't know I was going to be taking a Boston to Orlando trip, and mm-hmm. I did it in North Carolina. The brakes went out, and this great guy named Roy fixed me up. He, you know, he sent me over to his garage out in the woods, and he was talking. And he said, yeah, he didn't read books a whole lot, and he is a grandfather. He loves spending time with his kids. And I'm imagining Roy, if he's hearing this, he might be sitting back going, man, those people take a book out looking for fairies. That's so silly. There's no fairies. But I think if Roy took the book out with his grandkids looking for quote-unquote fairies, there'd be a whole lot of other things that they would encounter out in nature that Roy would love talking and introducing his grandkids to.
Exactly. Exactly. The Book of Fairies is the book that I really wished I had as a kid, because I was outside already looking for fairies. And in that process, that's when I discovered sort of the magic of nature, you know, that it is really, what happens in the natural world is really amazing. The science of it is inspiring and incredible and blows your mind away. Even now, to this day, I feel like that. When I see like a little woolly bear caterpillar right now in New Hampshire, it's getting cold. And this morning I was walking my dogs, and there on the ground was a tiny little woolly bear caterpillar. And I know, because this is the stuff that naturalists know, that in just a little bit of time, the woolly bear caterpillar is just going to go under a little bit of leaves and sleep for the winter, just with the covers of a little bit of leaves. And they're not going to freeze to death the way we would. Their body is able to protect them. And that is such cool information. Then comes the spring, they're going to warm up and they'll come back out and soon then turn into a cocoon to turn into an Isabella tiger moth. But the idea that this tiny little soft-bodied being can withstand the cold of winter just under the first layer of leaves is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And just as amazing as a fairy.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're not talking about the winter of North Carolina. We're talking about New Hampshire. It gets pretty cold up in New Hampshire.
Yeah. It's already cold up here. This morning it was like 38 degrees.
Oh, no.
I know.
I need to get on a plane.
I like it.
We celebrate the fact that there are so many benefits that kids get when they're read to. What are the, and they're, these benefits are documented by science. What kind of benefits has science shows kids get when they get out into nature with their families?
Oh, wow. The science is really it's really growing. So this body of evidence of how important it is for not just children, but adults to spend time outside. And I'll just name a few of the things. One thing is that being outside and having sunlight like in your face and in your eyes really is the right way for our bodies to get vitamin D, which is an essential vitamin for our bodies. I mean, we can drink it in milk and cereals and juices that are fortified, but it's so healthy for us to get some sunshine through our eyes is what they're finding into our bodies. And that vitamin D increases your immune system. It's builds your bones. It's really essential. So that's vitamin building. Another thing that they've found out is that time outside lowers our stress hormone cortisol. So just spending time 20 minutes to 2 hours outside can make a huge impact on your stress level. It's sort of as a way to refocus, and whether it's breathing in the air or just being outside, I don't really know why. We're just hardwired. That helps us relax. It increases our oxygen level. It increases our physicality, which is really important in terms of keeping a healthy body. And they find out that it can help you if you're feeling kind of unfocused and a little like overwhelmed at work. If you take a break and you walk outside, that you come back to your work and you're more focused. That's why recess is so important for kids. So going outside, moving their body, then they come in and it's like they're again ready to concentrate. And those are just some of the things. I just read a really interesting article about the link between walking on uneven ground when you're a child, crawling and walking on uneven ground, and it's later link in life to reading. So it's sort of like the mind and body and the crossover between the left and right hemisphere that enables your brain to get wired for what you need for reading. The science is just really evolving. And I could go on. This is the other thing I recently read is that when you bring infants outside, you might think, I would just go for a walk with my kid. This is, you know, healthy for me and my kid, but it is so healthy for your infant, because when you're outside, the infant's body is, the senses are all awake. They're feeling the wind on their skin. They're getting the sunlight in their eyes. They're hearing, they're smelling, they're breathing in this fresh air. And they find out that the brain creates a lot more synapses or connections outside than it ever does inside as an infant. So it's a great way to get your baby's brain really firing up.
Wow, that's really incredible. Boy, we've talked about a lot here today, Susie.
Yes, we have. Not just fairies.
Yeah, no, I love it. I love it. And I love that, you know, that you're on here and you're sharing this, the your books, you combine imagination with thoughts of magic and nature, and it's really wonderful. What are you working on now? What's the next project?
Good question. I am hopefully working on a book of potions next, or green magic, which is something that I also really loved doing as a child, making kind of concoctions and mixtures. But this will be really about, I'll be working hopefully with an herbalist, and they'll be able to make some things that they might be able to use in their life. So that's one project that I'm working on. And another project I'm working on is I write for Yankee Magazine, which is a magazine that's really about New England. And I'm working on a piece for their Old Farmer's Almanac on small mammals. So I love to write for kids, but I do a lot of magazine writing for adults too, which I love. I love it so much.
Awesome. Do you have a favorite small mammal?
Of course I do, Jed. That's a silly question. My favorite small mammal is the short-tailed shrew, which lives in North America, right in New England. And get this, hang on to your seat, because the short-tailed shrew is the only venomous mammal in all of North America. Yeah, venomous. So venomous. So it has a venom that is related, scientists found out, to cobra venom. And it wouldn't kill you, because the shrew is literally like I don't know, the size of a postage stamp. It's really small. No, it's bigger than that. It's like a sticky. It's like a post-it. You know, it's okay. About that big. And it's an insectivore, and it has to eat a lot, but it has a super fast metabolism. So if it comes across something too big to eat, let's say like a really big night crawler, big giant worm, it bites it with its venomous teeth. It doesn't have fangs, but it has grooves in its teeth where its saliva, which has the venom, gets into the animal, and then it paralyzes the animal, the earthworm, and the shrew can come back and feed on the earthworm for up to 10 days. It's
wow.
Sort of, the earthworm, it's not very nice for the earthworm, but it's no. Sort of living in the actual liminal stage between life and death, and the shrew comes back and munches away on it. It's a great way to stock up its freezer, I guess, its pantry.
Yeah.
How about that? Isn't that cool?
That's very cool and horrifying at the same time.
They made a horror movie about it in the 1950s, like Attack of the Giant Shrews, or Killer Shrews, I think it was called. And it was like on an island, of course, where there was some nuclear reactor that went astray, and the shrews got so giant and were killing people. It's my nightmare. Well,
I was before you told me that there was a movie, I was going to tell you should write a spooky miracle novel about the shrew, but it sounds like someone's already done it.
Oh, that's funny. Yes. Do you have a favorite small mammal?
I see lots and lots of chipmunks as I walk around, and they're awfully cute. So I'd probably go with the chipmunk.
Yeah. That's a pretty cute animal. It's just definitely not going to bite you with venom.
Yes, I certainly. Let's tell everybody where they can go to find out more about the Book of Fairies and more about you.
Sure. You guys can visit my website at susiespickle.com. And you can also find my book in all bookstores, especially your independent bookstores. And if they don't have it, you can ask them to carry it. I'm a big fan of libraries. I have a daughter who's a librarian, so I'm always giving a shout out to the public libraries.
Awesome.
So you can find my book there. And I'd love for everybody, every family, to have the Book of Fairies as their field guide for going outside in search of some magical beings.
We've had a great time speaking to the author of the Book of Fairies. Our guest has been Susie Spickle. Hey, Susie, write that next book soon. Come back on the show soon.
Thanks so much, Jed. Thanks for having me again. I loved every minute of it.
Thank you. This episode of Reading With Your Kids is brought to you by Once Upon a Dance. OnceUponADance.com, that is the place to go if you are looking for a magical way to get your kids moving. Once Upon a Dance brings stories to life with interactive books that inspire little ones to read, move, and imagine. Award-winning and teacher-approved, these whimsical tales are perfect for classrooms, story time, or family fun. Spark joy, build confidence, and dance with imagination. Discover more at onceuponadance.com or find Once Upon a Dance books at your favorite online bookstore. Well, I'll let you know that this episode of Reading With Your Kids is also brought to you by We're Going on a Space Adventure, written by Marie Nichols. This is a Reading With Your Kids certified great read. Blasting off and speeding through space, Graham cheers to the moon and beyond. But Bracken quickly learns that Graham has a fear of flying and that he must manage control of the spaceship. On the moon, they narrowly escape a hideous monster as a crater explodes, and on Mars, they need to outrun Martian creatures or risk becoming their dinner. Hoping to find a friendlier planet, they decide to try Jupiter. Then clank, 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 something is attacking the spaceship. You and your kids are going to love this book. It's fun. It's exciting. It celebrates intergenerational friendships, and we love those. We're going on a space adventure. By Marie Nichols, it is a Reading With Your Kids certified great read. Join us right now from Palm Springs in California, one of the coolest places. Well, I guess it's hot a lot, but lots of cool people live there. Our guest is here to celebrate his new picture book. It's called An Awesome Bird, The Pelican. Please welcome to the show, Rusty Austin. Rusty, how are you?
I'm doing great out here in California, and it's great to be on the show.
Thank you very much for being on the show. Rusty and I were just chatting about how him and Bad Bunny, like, maybe we'll run into each other on the street dance someday, sharing a soda or something.
You never know. He comes out here in the summer, so.
That's right. That's right. Puerto Rico's too hot, so go to Palm Springs. Tell me about an awesome bird, the pelican. In fact, it's interesting. The first time I saw a pelican in real life was down in Puerto Rico, and I was like blown away. I was watching them for a couple of hours.
They're fascinating birds, the way they hunt in flocks, I guess you'd call it, and their beaks are huge. They store fish in there for to eat tomorrow and the next day and the day after that. So that's kind of where the poem came from. It goes, an awesome bird, the pelican, he stores in his beak his food for the week. And what happened was I was on a site called Donors Choose, which is a kind of a GoFundMe for teachers. And I saw a teacher on there had posted a fundraiser for poetry books for kids. And so I got a hold of her through the site and offered to come in and read some of my other books. And while I was there, I saw how great all those kids were. So I pitched her the idea of having the kids do the illustrations for the Pelican book. And she was enthusiastic about it. So she arranged everything on her end. And we had like 40 kids or so. We had 40 poems and 80 kids. So I had 40 more pictures than I really needed. And so what I did for that was I wanted all the kids to get in the book. So I put all the pictures at the end of the book that didn't make the poem selection, because my books have about 40 poems in them.
So your book is a collection of poems that celebrate a whole bunch of wonderful animals.
Yes. And what I try to do is I make the poems all about 3, 4, or 5 lines long. Most of them are 4 lines and 12 to 15 words. And I try to always highlight something about the animal, its appearance or its diet or its habits or its habitat or something like that. So the kids can learn a little something too while they're reading it. In fact, I'll read one for you right now. It's about a caiman, and it goes like this. The caiman has a membrane that nictitates to better underwater see her dates. And so I figure nictitate is a fun word to say, and what it means is it's just like a clear membrane under the eyelid.
Uh-huh.
And so most kids probably don't know what that is. And so to roll it into the poem, I think, is helpful.
Yeah. Rusty, let me tell you a really quick story about a caiman. My dad, for some reason, when I was a kid, decided that caimans would be a good pet. And thankfully, he was a telephone cable repair guy. He'd climb the poles and go in the manhole. So we had these big, thick gloves, because very quickly, you needed the big leather gloves to be able to feed the caiman. And our caiman grew so big, we had to donate it to a zoo. It was like 6 feet.
Wow, yeah, because usually they're about 3 feet.
Yeah. But we were down in Costa Rica, my beautiful wife and I, my daughter and her now husband, and we were at a sloth sanctuary out in the forest in Costa Rica. And part of the tour of the sanctuary was to take a little boat ride on a little tributary where they release the sloths back into the wild. So we go down, and a young Costa Rican guy is our guide, and he's pushing the boat along, and he said, oh, well, there's a caiman. And my wife was looking, and she said, where? And the guide just kind of tapped the caiman with his stick, and the caiman didn't appreciate it, and he snapped his head and banged the boat. And
tried to eat him.
my wife was very unhappy and slapped the young Costa Rican guy. I said, don't you do that again.
Well, yeah, those things could probably jump right into the boat and bite you, I would think.
Yes, indeed. So where did your love for creating poetry and animals come from?
I think I grew up in Colorado, and so a lot of that lifestyle is hiking in the mountains and camping and backpacking on weekends.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got appreciation for nature, and you see animals, bears sometimes, elk, more likely deers a lot more, and chipmunks, ground squirrels, rodents like that. And so that kind of where I got my love of nature started. And then as I grew older, I was a editor at the school newspaper, so I was able to write a lot of stuff. And the animal poetry just kind of came naturally to me at the time. But then I kind of lost it for about 30 years when I got a job as a TV producer on reality television. And then when I retired in 2018, I decided to start publishing some of these poems on Facebook, and my friends encouraged me to put them in a book, so I did.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. You mentioned reality TV. One of the things that I was very surprised to learn shortly after the genre kind of became hugely popular is that reality TV really isn't all about reality. Am I told correctly about that?
The difference is we like to say in scripted television, you write the script and then you shoot the show. In reality, you shoot the show and then you write the script. So we'll have, I don't know, 300-400 hours of footage that we have to hone down to 1 hour, which is really good for your brain to learn how to edit and compress stuff, which helps me with my poetry because I try to make them so short and concise.
Yeah, yeah. Boy, I can't. I produced back way back in 1989. I produced a disabilities awareness video that was about an hour long, about 45 minutes long total. And it took us 2 weeks to edit it. And most of the video was a live shot, a three-camera shot of a live show. So there's very little actual editing needed, but it took us 2 weeks.
You have to hone it down. You got to cut out all the ums and ahs and breaths and teeth clatter and that kind of stuff. So it's a lot more complicated than it looks when you see the finished product.
Right, yeah.
And then, like, on Hell's Kitchen, we would shoot for 2 months and then edit for 10 months.
Hell's Kitchen was one of your shows.
That's the one I retired from. Yeah. That was my last show.
Okay.
And when you're in TV, the ideal job you get is something that will run for 10 or 12 years that you can retire from. And that was Hell's Kitchen was that for me. So it was a good end of my career. Yeah. I think it's still on.
I think you're right. Was that a tasty show to produce?
Oh, we got to eat all the food frequently during shooting, but after they're done shooting, you would have to order out or like that. But during the shooting, yes, it was very tasty.
Great, great, excellent. And so how is this new career going for you, going from shooting the script and then shooting the show and then writing the script from that to going back to your initial love of poetry?
I am doing quite well with it. I'm happy to be retired. And I'm very happy that I'm doing something that is good for the kids and good for me, too. And I've written now four. I'm working on the fifth book now. And it's been quite a journey and a great second career.
Yeah. I'm you know, curious if the first thought, if I had my publicist mind working right now, I would have said, Rusty, what are you doing with kids' books and poetry? You should be writing a tell-all about everything that went on behind the scenes in your reality shows.
You know, I thought about doing that, but I just it seems too much like regular work to me. So I'd much rather do something that I like that's fun.
Yeah.
There's a lot that went on behind the scenes, though, that you could tell stories about. Just a quick example: we had it wasn't on Hell's Kitchen, but I was on a show where the power to the studio went out 5 days before air, and the whole place was, there was no lights. And so the power is going to come on at midnight on a Friday. And so I had my pre-production meeting in the outer lobby using the lights from the street light. And so those people, was their first day there. I'm sure they thought, this guy is nuts. What are we doing here? But then the power came on at midnight and we all got to work and we got on the air, so it worked out.
That's great. Boy, what an exciting career you must have had. Do you take the time, I'm wondering, because I know in television everything is bang, bang, bang. It's so fast, and like you said, you have to pare down 300 hours of tape into a 30 or 60-minute show. With doing your poetry books, it's a little slower pace. Are you able now to sit down and think about your audience, think about the kids that are going to be cuddled up with their parents reading your book?
Yes, absolutely. And I try to – it takes me about a month to write those 40 poems. It doesn't come quickly. Sometimes I'll just be driving in the car, and like one time I saw some sheep, and so I wrote a poem. The ram will ram you so too that you, if either finds itself with nothing better to do. And that one just kind of came to me in the car when I saw the herd of sheep. But a lot of the stuff, I'll see an animal on the internet, and I'll just put his name in a file and go back and find it later. and figure out something that rhymes. And most of my rhymes are very simple. But sometimes, like, I have one about Egyptian hieroglyphics, which goes, the Egyptian hieroglyphics is cold-blooded true, but he's enthusiastic about meeting me and you. So I rhymed hieroglyphics with enthusiastics, which isn't really a word, but it works on the poem, so it was fun.
I love it. Hey, I'm curious. One of my favorite animals right now is the Scottish Highland cow. Have you written a poem about that, or can I plant that seed?
I have not, but I'm going to write that down right now. Scottish Highland cow?
Yes. I call them hippie cows because they all have the horns, but they also have bangs in their eyes like a hippie. And,
interesting.
Yeah. And it reminds me of what I looked like when I was a teenager.
Well, I'll say one thing I found out on this journey is that there's probably 10 or 12 or 13,000 species. So there's no limit to, or there's no end to what I can write about. I have an unlimited amount of stuff to go. And like I said, what I do is if I run across an interesting animal on the internet or sometimes in a magazine, I'll just make a note of it in a notebook that I keep and come back to it later.
Yeah. Now the choice to have those middle school kids, correct?
Yeah, they were seventh and eighth graders.
Okay.
So kind of older than my demographic, but old enough most of them were pretty talented at illustrations. Sure. Mm-hmm. Or some of them were very talented. Like the one kid, Andres, he drew the scorpion and he drew it completely from scratch with a pen and didn't even use an eraser on it. And it was an amazing drawing.
Wow. And that was not only a really ingenious thing, but talk about a generous gift to those kids.
Oh, it was great. They love that so much. And she gave them like an hour every week or a couple hours every week when they would set aside time just to work on it. And they probably worked on it for 6 months before we finally did it.
Okay.
And then I got it published and they had a literacy night where we showed up and gave books to all the kids and their parents. Which is fine. I don't mind giving them away. The Scholastic people were there selling books. I don't think they were too happy about it, but it was a really fun time. And you know, the kids buy more than one book. So
sure.
It's not like I was stealing that much business from them.
Exactly. Yeah. And they were part of the creation process. It's something to be celebrated.
Yeah. And the thing is, when I first read to them, I read from my book, The Unicorn Has One Horn. And the teachers nowadays, they have like a screen, they can screen any PDF you have right in their classroom. They don't use chalkboards anymore.
Right.
It's all done with screens and whiteboards. And so she screened all the pictures from that book. At the time, it was in pre-publication, and that was pretty exciting for them. And like I said, after I read the book, I realized how much the kids were getting into it. So it occurred to me that maybe I should ask her if she wanted to have the kids do the drawings. And she loved the idea. And I still talk to her from time to time, too. The book's been out now for, since February or something.
Wow, that's great. And have you heard any feedback from the kids or their parents that, you know, now that they're published artists?
Yeah, the kids were so happy. Per the school district lawyers, I had to give them, I couldn't really do a contract with them, so I gave them each $20 and a book and a bag of chips. And they were just over the moon with a bag of chips for some reason, I don't know. But they're eighth graders, so a lot of them maybe haven't ever even seen $20 that much in their life. I don't know. Yeah.
Wow. Lawyers. Boy, they lawyers, make
yeah. Around, huh? What I've done is they have a program there called the Avid College Program. And so I'll send them a check for a couple hundred dollars from profits.
Uh-huh.
Just to kind of keep my spoon in the pot, so to speak.
Yeah. Now, for your future books, because I know that there's going to be many books coming from you, are you thinking about working with young student artists again?
Yes. In fact, the book I'm writing now, The Two-Headed Snake, I actually hired two of the kids out of that class to do the drawings, and they have just recently finally got them to me, so I'm putting that together. And they're wonderfully talented kids. So, and I think I paid them each $500, which is a normal illustrator cost about 10 grand. So it's been good for me too.
Well, we don't want the lawyers to hear that.
No, I don't want the lawyers to know anything about it. But like I said, it was the poem, it was the Palm Springs school district lawyers that got involved with the other book. This one is strictly between me and the kids' parents.
Right.
And I think they're both about 13, so I had to get their parents to sign the contract.
Sure. Yeah. That makes perfect sense. But this is a wonderful thing that they can put on their resume.
Yes, and absolutely.
And definitely get into college.
They have the book. I gave them each like 10 copies of the book, or the kids that are doing it now, I will, when the book is published, so they can hand those out to their friends if they want, or their parents and grandparents.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful opportunity for them. And it's good for me too, like I said.
Yeah. Absolutely. Hey, I would be remiss if I didn't take this opportunity to ask, is there another juicy reality show behind the scenes story you can share with us on this family?
Yes.
Show?
When we were on a show early on, it was called Nanny 911.
Oh, yes.
there was a bidding war between Fox and ABC for the British version called Super Nanny. And so Fox wanted to get Nanny 911 on the air before Super Nanny. So we literally had to hire an army and work 24/7 around the clock. And there was the guy in charge of the reality programming at Fox would come over about once every 2 or 3 days to screen. And what he would do is they would do a Starbucks order. And part of my job was to get a runner to run to Starbucks and pick up all the coffee for like 15 executives. And so well, what happened is they'd call and say, okay, we'll be there at 1. So we'd go pick up coffee at 1. Oh, we're not coming until 3. So we'd drink all the coffee. They'd come back at 3. Oh, now we're not coming until 5. So they'd finally show up about 8 or 9 o'clock at night, and we were all just completely wired from drinking coffee. It doesn't keep you. You have to drink it and go get more. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the money guys were like, why are you spending all this money on coffee? And I had to explain it to them. I can't help it. It's the Fox executives. They get what they want.
Exactly. So. Exactly. Hey, Rusty, we should tell everybody where they can go to find out more about an awesome bird, the pelican, and find out more about you.
It's on Amazon, and it's also at rustyaustin.com. And there's an about section about me on there, and my other books are also on that. Beware the Grizzly Bear, the Unicorn Has One Horn, and The Carrot is Orange. And actually, the carrot book is about food. So that's something that kids like too, like chocolate sundaes or macaroni and cheese, or like kids' foods. And poems about food, yeah. So
I love it. I love it. We've had a great time speaking to the author.
Yes, thanks. Thanks for having me on. It's been great.
You're welcome. Check out An Awesome Bird, the Pelican. Hey, Rusty Austin, thanks for being with us.
Thanks again. I'll talk to you soon.
We are so very happy that you spent part of your day with us here at Reading With Your Kids. If this episode made you smile or gave you something to think about, please pass it on. Share the link with someone you love. Leave a 5-star review and hit that subscribe button so you can join us for the next episode of the show. Hey, we'd love for you to connect with us on social media as well. Facebook.com/readingwithyourkids. At Reading With Your Kids on Instagram, and at Jedley Magic on X. Our YouTube channel, youtube.com/readingwithyourkids. That's where you can find all of our Drawing With Your Kids videos and our STEM is Family Fun videos. Those are really, really great. And you can also listen to Reading With Your Kids at youtube.com/readingwithyourkids. If you haven't already done so, please check out our website, readingwithyourkids.com. It is the hub for all things Reading With Your Kids, including finding out how you can be a guest here in the show, visiting our Certified Great Read Wall of Fame, and exploring amazing new books. I want to give a big heartfelt thanks to today's guest, Susie Spickle. Please be sure to check out The Book of Fairies. Also want to thank Rusty Austin. Please be sure to check out An Awesome Bird, the Pelican. I want to thank my team, Fatima Khan, Chris Daugherty. I want to thank my beautiful wife for all the support she gives me. Most of all, we want to thank you. You are helping to shape a kinder, smarter world every time you read with your kids. I'll be looking for you in the next episode of Reading With Your Kids.
My friend is a veil. She makes me smile. We love- snack.